Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Coming up on the free-for-all, my boss, Sam Walker, global sports chief of the Wall Street Journal, talks about his controversial exit. Well, it's not that controversial, but we're going to call it controversial. Free-for-all.
You're listening to Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is Jason, and welcome to the Free For All. Big night in basketball last night. We are recording this on Thursday, April 14th, and if you lived on the East Coast, as I do, you're probably up rather late, if you're a basketball fan, because you had an incredible doubleheader. You had Kobe Bryant's final game as a Los Angeles Laker, because next year he'll be a San Antonio Spur. His last game as an NBA player. And then you also had the Golden State Warriors adding a 73rd win, a record 73rd win to a already historic season. Jim Cherusmi is with me as always. Jim, did you stay up?
I stayed up and watched.
Were you into it? Did you switch over, as many people did, from the Warriors game to watch the end of Kobe?
You know what? I never started watching the Warriors game. I watched
Kobe all the way through.
He missed his first five shots, yeah. And I was hooked for the rest of the game. Because, I mean, it's great television because the game meant nothing.
Yeah.
And Kobe shot the ball every time he touched the ball. And it was great. It was
so
actually
like
very
an all-star game.
Yes.
Did you find Kobe charming, you know, in his... conclusion.
Charming is not the right word to describe Kobe, but it was funny. You know, I like the hug with Shaq at the end.
Yeah, he heated up. Okay, like everyone will remember this game for the 60 points, but it needs to be underlined. He took 50 shots, which is a spectacular number of shots. I don't believe anyone has shot that many shots in the NBA this season, and no one really shoots that much ever. And he didn't shoot well.
No.
Until the very end, which he was 5 of 5 to close it out, including a pair of
And they rallied
throws.
To win. Because for the most of the game, the Jazz was winning.
I felt a little bit like I was watching WWE, watching the Jazz kind of go through the motions in the final 90 seconds. But hey, who am I to be a spoiler?
But I think that's sort of why, you know, it was so entertaining, was that there was no stakes, but yet it meant so much to Kobe. And he had trouble catching his breath at some parts. It was very fun.
I want to switch really quickly to a topic that's close to both of our hearts, which is professional boxing. And we haven't had a chance to talk about it on the free-for-all, but Manny Pacquiao won a boxing match last Saturday rather decisively against Timothy Bradley, whom he beat once, lost sort of controversially to once, but looked as good as he's looked in the last few years, including his sort of non-fight against Floyd Mayweather last May. Any takeaway for it for you?
Well, it's funny because at Saturday night, you know, it's like 12:30 at night, and I get a text from Jason, are you watching? And immediately, like, you know, it's funny because we probably are probably the only two people probably in at least our sports department that even cared about this fight.
Who might watch this fight, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was very, I mean, you know, I think it's a little bit, he was a handpicked opponent. Pacquiao had beaten this guy twice, arguably, you know, first time was a controversial loss. He looked good, but I don't know. I mean, I hope he walks away. I really do.
It's not the worst thing to walk away from, but what it did was, because he was so animated and because he took the fight to Bradley, it does what it always does in boxing, which is to reanimate the discussion. And because Pacquiao has been historically such a great draw for the sport, you know, of course everyone's now thinking, okay, put him up against Canelo Alvarez and maybe another fight with Floyd. Who would say no to $250 million? Do you think we get there with either one of those scenarios?
I mean, I think that Floyd would definitely come back to fight Pacquiao because I think now he's not scared of him and knows he can beat him again. But does the public really want that? I feel like Pacquiao and Kobe are perfect, you know, comparisons to each other.
Now,
right?
I got a note from Team Pacquiao. I know you have some friends in Team Pacquiao, too. But I got a note from Team Pacquiao. I said, wow, that was quite a fight. And I heard back said, yeah, it's a lot easier to fight with two hands. So the word is out with the Pacquiao people that they feel he had one arm tied behind his back against Mayweather dealing with that shoulder injury.
I'm glad that now we are we have some connections now with future senators of the Philippines.
Presidents of the Philippines, perhaps. Potentially. Lampley was talking that up on Sunday or Saturday, or I guess it was Sunday morning. Okay, Jim. Let's cut dilly-dallying with the sports talk because we have a much more important topic to get into. We have a special guest in the studio, and it's not often that you get to bring in somebody who you're, first of all, eager to talk to because he's a fascinating guest, but also quite responsible for us sitting in this studio because he hired the both of us.
It's true.
And the guest, without further ado, is Wall Street Journal Global... I guess we should say outgoing Wall Street Journal global sports editor, Sam Walker. Sam Walker, thanks for joining the free-for-all.
Guys, pleasure to be here. It's my first podcast.
Ever?
Ever.
Of any kind.
Invited me on the WSJ Sports.
Yeah, well, the audience podcast is about to find out why. now, Sam, I say outgoing because in the last week you have made the rather... significant life decision to abandon your ducklings of the WSJ sports department to move on to, I won't say greener pastures because I don't know if it's a good move for you, but move on to newer pastures or new pastures with a job on the, what is it, the classified section?
That's right.
Does it feel like a college coach leaving for like the NFL or something?
Come on. I'm saying, you know, it could be completely lateral to me. I don't know. What is the job that you're moving to?
It's not clear.
What's it called? Deputy front page editor.
I'm the deputy enterprise editor. And
wasn't that Spock's job?
That's right. It's like there's some Klingons involved and some. No, Enterprise is a new designation at the Journal. This job did not exist before.
We weren't enterprising until you got
hired.
No,
there was actually a complete lack of enterprise, which was the problem. So that's my job, is to whip you guys in shape. Hmm. The Enterprise desk is really, you know, there used to be something, you know, back in the old days when we were all, walking around on four legs called... Page One,
yeah,
which was, you know, when you had the newspaper.
For you kids listening, they actually would put out a print product of the newspaper, which people would throw into a driveway, and you'd pick it up.
Yeah,
it was tactile,
right? Where you kept the car that you owned that you didn't call on your phone. It was Page One was this sort of great institution at the Journal.
Yes.
It was this, you know, incredible collection of the best journalists we had. You know, anyway, so it was
the
a separate
curated thing. Most important yes. subjects for the world's most popular newspaper.
That's right. No, it was big time. But now we're in the digital age.
Yeah.
So
nobody
as
cares.
You know, well, you know, there's it's really about the stories and how the story performs in a sort of holistic way. So we've split up Page One between the news, the everyday news, and Enterprise. And Enterprise is like, you know, investigative stories, long term. Yeah. Serious reportage, and then, you know, the A-head, which is another Wall Street
Journal. The A-head, of course, is the classic Wall Street Journal story, which is beloved by many readers, which is oftentimes a very well-written and reported eccentric tale from really anything, anywhere around the world.
Well put.
Okay.
So lateral move, what do you guys think? Come on, I want your honest opinion.
I think you're taking over a 500 franchise. You could take it in either direction.
Okay. Cheruzny, come on.
You have
lateral
to get
move.
The story. You have to get the stories above the fold.
Above
that's
the
another
fold.
Another point.
Well, you know, this right. Let's just talk about this for 1 second, which is the notion of what a front page constitutes, because as you said, you know, this is more people now read the Wall Street Journal. I don't think it's a secret digitally than read it in print, though our print subscribership is very robust. But it does change sort of the idea of what a front page is. Now, I'm old enough to have come of age when front pages were the greatest thing a reporter could ever be part of. Nowadays, a little different. Still an honor, still an honor. But what role does a front page play in the composition of a newspaper in 2016? I imagine this was in your interview, Sam.
That's right, which I'm sure I've completely flubbed. I think page one's important. I mean, look, you know, one of the great things about the technological revolution, about the freedom of information moving around in social media, is that, you know, there's crowdsourcing. And I mean, everyone can kind of choose what stories are important to them, what they think is most important. So, you know, the role of the paper and the institution is slightly lessened because, you know, we used to tell you what the news was, and now we just put it out there and you kind of tell us what the news is. But, you know, there are certain stories that, you know, we take seriously and we pour a ton of, you know, effort and resources into that may not be, you know, the cat video everyone wants to read, but it's something that's really going to change something or is really going to have a deeper impact. And, you know, the paper needs a way of saying this story matters. We put a lot of work in this story. It's important. It's serious-minded. It's, you know, or it's meant to have an impact, or else it's the best, most entertaining stuff that we do, and that's what the idea is. The idea is, like, and these are the stories that we really want to have some juice behind. And that's what, it's the same concept. Just, we're just flagging what we think is important as our best work and making sure that it has a little asterisk next to it. You know,
you see Jim's falling asleep.
That's right.
Jim's,
no, I know.
Completely asleep. Okay.
I was trying to think of a joke.
This is what's in the future. And frankly, we feel abandoned and we don't really care about your future. We want to talk about sports though, because you did hire both of us. You know, two of the worst mistakes you made during your 80-year tenure as a sports editor. How long have you been the sports editor of the Wall Street Journal?
Well, you know, 2009, March 3, 2009 was our first issue.
You were
of the
appointed.
Daily
okay.
Paper. But no, we did have a weekly sports page before then.
Yes.
So I technically was the sports editor, but it didn't really.
And you were the sports guy for quite a while before that at the Wall Street Journal.
I was the one man band.
You were the one man band. That's right.
Me. You know, and everywhere I went, you know, it was ridiculous because everyone would make these cracks about it. I didn't know the Wall Street Journel.
Oh, they still
sports.
They still make those cracks.
Those
believe
cracks.
Me. When you were starting out as a sports writer of the Wall Street Journal, you know, was the subject matter, you weren't on the news ever, probably, right? It wasn't like, hey, Walker, get down to the Eastern Conference Finals. We need a story, stat, right? That didn't happen.
Never. No, there was no, you know, coverage of actual events. And our deadlines were so bad. Yeah. I mean, you know, we didn't even think about trying to cover anything.
Right.
I mean, I would go to the major events. I would kind of do a curtain raiser, and I would sit around the whole time afterwards while all the other reporters were diligently
working.
Was
every question you got, the Wall Street Journal covers sports?
Yeah, pretty much. It got so bad, in fact, like, I got so many funny looks, I just decided at one point, you know what, I'm going to start wearing a suit and tie to every game because that's what people expect me to look like. They just think I'm a complete whack job if I'm wearing, you know, the sports writer outfit. So I just started wearing a suit, but...
Well, you'll be happy to know that athletes around the world now just light up with excitement whenever you introduce yourself as being from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
It is true that athletes, I believe, you know, because I've worked at some other places, are quite receptive to the Wall Street Journal in that, first, we're not a, you know, typical sports publication, but they all, you know, see themselves as moguls in training, many times at least. and in some cases, they are moguls. And so they're amenable to the idea of talking about maybe even the markets before sports with the Wall Street Journal. But Sam,
yes,
you became the editor of this section, and there were sort of two parts of this. There was a dedicated page in the National Edition, and there was also dedicated coverage in the Greater New York section, which, if you get the New York edition of the Wall Street Journal, is a very comprehensive look at the life of the city or the Greater New York region each day. And you went from, you know, going 0 miles an hour to 300 miles an hour. And what did you know you wanted, and how close did you get to achieve it?
I was just so astounded by the pace at which this happened. I mean, you know, the new ownership came in, News Corp, and they bought
this. This is Rupert Murdoch purchased the paper and is no stranger to sports. Of course, you know, made a seismic move in his career once buying the NFL for Fox Television, which changed the whole landscape of TV. So this is a guy who feels sports is a critical element, right, of coverage.
Right. I mean, it all started with one of my, you know, someone else at the paper was in the elevator with Murdoch, and he said, "Where's my sport page? You know, we need a sport page." So, I mean, that's really kind
of... That's a great Rupert, by the way.
No, too. I know. Well, that's sort of the best Rupert I can do. But no, anyway, it came from there. And I mean, you know, within 3 months, you know, we were up and running from zero.
Yeah.
And
at a time when, we should point out, I mean, it feels like it's just never stopped, but at a time, really, we were in the backwash of the financial crisis and papers everywhere were dying and contracting. And all of a sudden, you were given a budget and new staffing and pages and all this wackiness. It was like bizarro world of newspapers.
It was completely sound. The day we launched, March 3, 2009, if you look at the stock market, that was the absolute bottom. Literally, the day that we were at NASDAQ was, you know, rang the bell. You know, it was the bottom of the market. So it was crazy, and it was a weird place to be because, you know, here we are hiring people and staffing up and trying to figure out how to put out a daily sports product and how to cover sports the whole world over.
And what was your mission statement, Sam? Because, I know a little bit about your worldview, but you're bored easily, I think it's fair to say. You're a little bit you feel a lot of coverage out there is rote. We don't need to pick on anybody in particular, but you feel like a lot of sports coverage is repetitive. And what did you want to do? What did you want to make a Wall Street Journal section on sports read like?
I wanted to see what I could get away with, honestly. I mean, I just didn't believe that, you know, this was happening. And I mean, I think the mandate was so – I think what, you know, what I was sort of – the hint I was given is that, you know, we really needed to kind of pump some energy into the journal that hadn't been there before. And, I mean, that was the signal I was getting, and I was perfectly happy with that because I felt like – there was
Shake
so much more the paper can do. Right. You know, and we didn't cover, you know, we always did the second day story. We didn't cover things.
Yeah.
You know, we were very careful about having a point of view, you know, in coverage. I felt like we were often too cautious. And when in most topics, that's exactly how we should approach it. But sports is different.
Yeah.
I mean, sports is a much different thing. And you have to have a point of view and you have to have some fun with it. And you have to take some risks and try different things. And, you know, so we started just pushing it as far as we could go, and to our incredible surprise, we just weren't fired. We kept doing things that we thought were just too far this time.
Not and only that, but the reception from journal readers was what?
They loved it. I mean, I was amazed. I saved all those letters that we got early on because they were so amazing. I mean, people were raving about the quality of the writing, but also the humor that was there and the sort of, I think what they loved was this sort of, you know, serendipity. I mean, you just didn't know what you were going to get from day to day because we would do a serious story, a news story, an investigation. We'd have one of your columns that was very funny. We'd have a feature, a game story. I mean, they just kind of, we kept keeping people on their toes, and they seemed to like that too.
Do you think that not having any kind of institutional history, I mean, this is not to say, we should add that The Wall Street Journal did have, including some of the things that Sam did, some really great sports writing in its past, some really groundbreaking in several instances investigative sports writing, but it did not have a dedicated page. The fact that we didn't have that kind of DNA, do you think it helped?
Total liberation. Yeah. No, it was amazing. Yeah. I mean,
there was nobody saying, oh, we don't do that.
No, and there's no, I mean, you know, I think the problem with sports coverage generally, especially print sports coverage, is, you know, it's not someone's fault. I mean, you know, these sections were organized, you know, back in the 1920s when there was tons of advertising against sports and they had tons of space and you had to cover everything and, you know, all
and
these
and they were cash cows, frankly.
They were
these were, you know, you look at the tabloids in New York, both the sports sections for the News and the Post were a main reason to buy the News or the Post.
Right. And they were, you know, as a result, you know, when you what happens when you have a cash cow, you get lazy. You stop improving the product. You make all kinds of decisions about expediency.
You don't have to tell me.
You hire people like Jason Gay. And
you're slacking off.
Yeah, no, it's terrible.
Now, who is your hire number one? Is it Futterman?
Yeah, well, Futterman predates the sports.
He predates the second. He was hired from the Star Ledger as a what?
Yeah, he was hired as the sports business reporter at the Wall Street Journal, which we had in addition. I was the columnist.
We also
had a sports business writer.
So Matthew Futterman was employee number one. Who was employee number two?
Reed Albergati was one of the first employees that we had. Now, I stole him. He was a one of the top editor's assistants, and I brought him in as a reporter.
Yeah. Now, he's since
left. He works at what, Cosmo.com?
Yes.
Or pets.com?
Yes, that's right.
It is. He's in the Silicon Valley. Jim, do you know what that is?
I've heard of it.
He's in the Silicon Valley writing about Silicon Valley things, but a brilliant, brilliant writer. And Sam?
Yes.
To your point about not having the institutional history and the way that sections had to change, one thing that I can't help think, you know, even in these 7 or so years of doing this section, that we had one hand behind our back in this respect, that we weren't a paper that could go on late deadlines and give you the scores and run what we call agate of, like, you know, here's what, you know, the box scores and here's all that kind of stuff. That's just what we weren't. We didn't have the metabolism to be able to do that. What has happened, and it was already happening, but has really happened in these 7 years, is that nobody in print can do that anymore, because all that information, it's not just SportsCenter anymore. It's so instantaneously delivered via social media, via internet, very everything that we have in our hands with devices, that the idea of a newspaper being your first read of sporting events in the world is gone. And
yeah.
So everyone has to think creatively. And so in a weird way, what I'm trying to say, Sam, is you are ahead of your time.
Yes, absolutely. I was a visionary. No, we got very lucky in the sense that, you know, our whole style at the Journal, because, you know, our deadlines were so bad, I mean, we were always writing ahead of story. We're trying to write the story ahead of the story. Yeah. And, you know, but it forced us to think differently and to try to come up with different angles and ways to approach stories. And, you know, everything turned in our direction, because suddenly, as you said, I mean, all these news outlets that had just sort of gotten kind of fat on just writing about things right after they happened, realized that they had to come up with thematic stories, and they had to come up with features that were interesting.
You had to bang some pots and pans
analysis
together.
Yeah, and you had to yell and scream and do funny things and write about, you know, the Rally Squirrel's lawyer, you know, writing a letter to, you know, you had to do things like that. So, so
great story, by the way.
That was a great story. I have it here. I'd be happy to read it. If I'm boring, I'll just read your column, because that was my favorite.
No, that'll kill off the remainder of the audience. We're going to take a quick break, Sam, because we have very, very good sponsors of this show. And we'll be right back on the Free For All with Sam Walker.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
Okay, this is Jason Gay. We are back with Sam Walker, the departing sports editor of the Wall Street Journal, who's leaving to run the, I believe it's the online shopping column.
That's right, cosmetics and umbrellas.
Yeah. I think it's the umbrella column. Yeah, it's called Under It with Sam Walker.
It's like, get under it.
Actually, I would read an umbrella column, Jim, wouldn't you?
That would be pretty good.
You know what? There's going to be an umbrella column. I guarantee it. Okay, Sam. Jim, let me tell the story of how I got hired at the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
So what happened was...
I tell my side of the story?
I want to tell my side of the story because it's probably all wrong. And then you can...
I'll fill you in on what really happened, yes.
They offered the job to somebody else, okay? They offered the job to somebody else, and then they offered the job to somebody else, and then they offered the job to a couple of somebody else's. And one of the somebody else's happened to call me and said, hey, there's this job. I mentioned you might be interested in it. And let me tell you how much Wall Street Journal reading I had done in my life, Jim. Close to nada.
Not even page one?
Not even page one. A few stories here and there. You know, I grew up in Boston, so that seismic Reggie Lewis story that the sports team did years ago was really huge. But I just wasn't I wasn't a reader. I barely had a checking account. You know, I just was not a Wall Street Journal guy. I knew what it was. I go into the office. I had to tell me where it was. You were still downtown. I wore sneakers to the interview. I was like, whatever with these Wall Street Journal guys. You know, never thinking in a million years that it made any kind of sense whatsoever. And now here we are, years later, and it was the worst decision I ever made. No. What's your recollection of it, Sam?
Well, that's actually closer to my recollection than I thought. So we were struggling about. We needed a columnist. We needed someone. Yeah.
Everybody was saying no. Let's face it.
Well, yeah, or they were saying no, or the columns, you know, we wanted someone who's really funny. We kind of wanted this unicorn, you know, we were looking for like the perfect voice. And, you know, we heard about you, we had you in. I remember Mike Miller, my boss, you know, calling me in and saying, well, just come meet with this guy, Jason Gay. And I mean, I'd heard a little bit about Jason. I'd heard, you know, I knew his name. I mean, I kind of vaguely knew his stuff that he'd done in GQ. And so he comes in, and you got to understand, if you've seen The Big Short, where the thing where they go into Moody's, you know, there's that woman in Moody's, like that's the whole journal. I mean, that's what everybody looks like, you know, that's what their offices look like. That's how they, you know, it's like they have to bag lunch, you know, it's this really dowdy place. We all have pleated pants and ugly sweaters.
Also, in fairness to what the Wall Street Journal has become, it is a drastically hip place.
No, it's gotten,
I mean,
hip.
You know, it basically looks like the showroom of Christian Dior. It's radically hip. And Mike Miller walks around in a Tom Brown suit.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Well, that's your influence. Okay. Yeah. No, but anyway, so Jason comes in, as he said, in his jeans and his sneakers and his skinny knit tie, you know, this blasé magazine guy air about him. And, you know, I just did not see, I didn't see it. And I don't know. I didn't. I mean, I'll admit, I did not see it. So, So we asked him to write a test column.
Yes, which I had never done. In my life.
It was beneath you, you know, to even ask you to do it. But anyway, so we asked you to do
it. A test column is you cover sports, but they don't put it in the paper. They just test. It's like, you know, you're like writing a flight simulator.
Do you still have that in your inbox?
I tried to find, I swear I'm going to find it. Like, yeah. I've tried several times. Yeah. I think
it's like
it got
profile of Keith dialed up.
No, it was here. So anyway, there's another part of this story, which is like how funny fate can be. So I had zero faith in the idea that Jason Gay was our man. Yeah. So this column came in. I remember it was a Sunday night. It was probably 9 p.m. I don't know what I was doing there, but I was there in the office. And I saw this note come with an attachment from Jason Gay. And I was about to walk out of the office. I was about to go home. I was like, oh, this will be rich. I opened it up, and it was like, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was like the easiest, most obvious decision I ever made. I mean, it was just so funny and perfectly witty. And I remember you were talking about your Kazakh barber, you know, and what he was talking about.
The Uzbek barber.
The Uzbek barber, that's right.
By the way, Jim is now vomiting all over the console at this slobber fest going on.
You know what? I actually was going through some of the binders. We actually have binders here at the Wall Street Journal of every sports page in the history in the 7 years.
Yeah, man.
And I was reading some of the early couch columns. And one did mention paying $59, only $59, to watch a Manny Pacquiao fight.
Oh,
with your
brother. Wow. Hey. Wow. And when did Jimbo come along?
We stole Jim. Actually, I didn't hire Jim. I can't take credit for that. I just stole him. Most of what I did was I would just go around journals stealing people's employees.
Basically, my first contribution to sports was I was a big tennis guy. And I basically, spent a week at the Journal. But I spent a week at the Journal covering food, and we'd made a food tournament. And basically, it was Sam's idea.
Was this the U.S. Open thing?
It was at the U.S. Open.
Oh, okay.
We did a bracket. We had a very serious bracket. And I think, you know, in some ways that sums up WSJ Sports.
Right.
In that, you know, we were at this event, this tennis tournament, and we decided to do something completely different than what other people were doing.
That was it.
The rest
and now
is history.
Everyone does food tournaments. You know, we should have copyrighted it.
That's totally
That is really funny. So, Sam, let's get a little bit personal here. All right, what is your favorite sport? Like, if you were turning on the TV and you're flipping channels and you happen upon a sporting event, what would make you stop?
It has honestly evolved. And you know, for a while there was baseball, and then... But you know, I'd say probably college football. I think that's
college
the thing.
And you went to a commuter school in Ann Arbor.
I went to the Mackinac Island Community College.
Oh, yeah. The University of Michigan. Michigan. And can it be said here on the air that you were a passing acquaintance, at least of the current football coach?
Yes. No. We had my best friend growing up was his brother was Jim Harbaugh's best friend. So. We did cross paths back when
you partied with Harbaugh.
I don't know if I partied.
How many years did you overlap?
He was, I don't even remember. He was much older. I mean, then. I mean, he was older than you know. He was in college, and he was a huge celebrity. So we kind of looked at him with awe. But yeah, no, he's the same. He's you know, my memories of him then are similar to now. I mean, he was just full of enthusiasm, and you know,
bad khakis.
I think this was pre-khakis.
Yeah.
He had a beat-up Volkswagen Bug that's held together with bungee cords. So I don't know if he got that from a booster. I hope not.
Yeah.
It would be bad.
That'll just blow the lid off the program. Okay, so we got college football.
And the Schembechler. I one of Bo's
here we go. Schembechler.
Sons, you know, was my age. So, you know, Bo came to a couple of my Little League games, and it was dramatic.
When was the last time you cried watching a sporting event? What brought a tear to your eye?
I don't know if I've ever cried. I mean, the craziest I ever got was when Michigan won the national championship in 97, and I broke the cardinal rule of sports writers and stood on my chair at the Rose Bowl.
At the Rose Bowl. I love it.
And clapped because I was just like, screw these rules.
And did the New York Times guys give you the stink eye?
I think everybody gave me the stink eye. In fact, I was in the bottom row in the far corner, so the entire press box must have seen me do this. But I didn't care. They won. I'd never won. I'd watched them lose Rose Bowl since I was four.
Jim, one thing that is interesting about Sam, I believe, one of the many things interesting about Sam as a sports editor is that Sam doesn't like Gona stuff. I mean, he loves putting reporters on the ground and having boots everywhere you can. We have people in Europe. We have people all around the world to every global sporting event. But Sam's always the guy like, yeah, I'm going to go to the World Cup. Yeah, I'm not going. I'm going to the Olympics this year. Yeah, no. If something came up, I'm going to skip it. And then he turns around and, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but Sam's working on a book, a sports book, which is going to just park like a Winnebago atop the bestseller list when it comes out in 2047. But you went everywhere around the world.
I did. I'm not everywhere.
Well, you went to South Africa, I believe.
No.
You went to New Zealand.
No. I have not been to New Zealand yet. That's still to come.
Okay. But you went to London and you like lived like a real writer in London.
Yeah. Yeah, and I went to Cuba, I went to Rio, I went to all over Europe.
How come you never want to go or hang out with us?
Well, you know, here's the thing. This
I think
me
you
crazy.
Love walking around the newsroom. We're all gone.
Well, it is pretty quiet. It's really easy to think to yourself. No, part of the thing is I'm not a crowds guy. I don't like crowds. I don't like mob scenes. I mean, I'm not someone who really loves going to. I go to sporting events. I don't love it.
So, if someone offered you a ticket to last night's game, Warriors,
I would have gone. I would have gone. No, I'm not a hermit. I mean, the other problem is though. This is another thing, and I've wrestled with this more than anything I think in this job is that, you know, here's the thing. I'm an editor, right? And an editor is supposed to be the guy behind the scenes, making sure everything works, and trying to support his reporters and make sure that they've got everything they need to do the best possible job they can. How me being in London or Sochi or South Africa, you know, or Brazil for the World Cup, it doesn't help that. It's great for me. It's fun to go. It's fun to have beers with the guys, and maybe that's good for morale. But, you know, the fact is an editor's job is to make pages and to publish stories, and there's just no argument that that's done better from the scene. And you know, I think that's really at the end of the day. I feel like it'd be great for me, but if I had minions to sort of do the work for me, then I would do it. But okay. But that's the main reason, honestly.
I'm semi buying that excuse. Part of me also believes you don't want to be in an elevator with me and John Clegg and Jim and
right. Well, you guys,
Ben Cohen.
I can't keep up with the
okay now. Let's ask you some other questions. Give me the name, if you feel comfortable, give me a name of one high-profile person from the world of sports. It can be an athlete, it can be an executive, it can be an owner, it can be anybody who's called up to scream at you.
Oh, God. It's a fairly long list of people. Well, you know, I mean, the obvious one is Lance Armstrong, you know,
Lance Armstrong, the
great many times.
Stripped winner of 7 Tour de Frances.
Yes.
Who was covered extensively by the previously named Reid Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell, who chronicled their investigation in Wheelmen, available now in paperback.
Tremendous book. I recommend it.
But you know, Lance would call you.
Yeah. A lot. I mean, he does this a lot. I'm not the only one. I mean, he really kind of worked the media like nobody else. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of... You know, long. It's very hard to get him off the phone when he's angry.
But it was interesting. But he never said anything on the record, right?
No, he would never go on the record, and so it was just, you know, for you know, for the sake of just berating you. But no, you know, we had good exchanges, and, you know, he's very, you know, it was very important, I think, because we, you know, in our reporting, because, I mean, it was a chance to understand his thinking and his motives, and it helped, I think it helped our make our stories better. But
well,
I remember one time, let me tell you another one. So the one time I don't know how this happened, but we have a weekend place, and you know, and had a phone that I didn't even realize was connected anymore. This was a few years ago, but
yeah.
The phone rang, and I was like, "Wow, that's, I haven't heard the phone ring in a long time." And I picked it up, and it was the owner of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, who was just purple with rage over a story that I'd done. And I remember I couldn't even get to ask him how he got this number, how he found. I have no idea to this day how he found it.
Sam has a big house in the Hamptons, so the guy was probably across the street, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's more of a shack north of the Hamptons, but anyway.
Well, those are doozies.
Yeah, well, there've been a lot, and you know, look, I think that's important. I mean, I think you know we really want to write impactful things. We need to write about things that people don't want us to write about, and you know, we're more than happy to pick up the phone and have that confrontation if there's a confrontation.
But at the same time, you're competing against a pretty broad group of sports outlets that, you know, when they're not sort of just, you know, forwarding each other's work along, they're just, you know, they're doing quick drops and hits and things like that. And we're still, I don't want to say we're in the Stone Ages here because it performs a very vital and important thing. But, you know, we're still in the business of running stories by lawyers and, you know, making sure that we're getting our facts correct. You know, we're never perfect, but we try to get it as correct as possible. Those, you know, that backbone still critical to you?
Absolutely. No, I can't imagine working at a place where it didn't exist.
You're not a fast and loose rumor guy, Walker, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, they've kept me from being that probably, but no, I'm not. And I think there are a lot of stories that we, you know, that we get that anyone else would run with. And we're just, you know, we have higher standards. And, you know, there are also stories that, you know, we're going to be slow on because, you know, we've got to absolutely have it nailed down, and we're not going to join the rumor train. We're not going to pile on. We're not going to assume that what's been put out there is accurate. So, you know, it's frustrating for reporters sometimes because, you know, the speed at which the sports media business moves is massive and rapid, and it happens on social media in a blink of an eye. But, you know, we just never want to be wrong. And, you know, we're not going to be if we can help it.
I remember long conversations with you about whether or not I should tweet.
Do you remember that? The agony of that?
The agony of
tweeting.
See,
I thought I was pro-tweet. Like, I was
pushing
you
toward
tweet.
No, you were pro-tweet. No. You were pro-tweet. Right. I just thought it was like, what? Free work for Twitter? I don't get it. And I'm still waiting to get paid for it from somebody. But it's not happening. But yeah, I mean, and in fairness to you know, the digital world, we have we've gotten much more nimble. We update stories at all hours. We have people over in Europe, people in Asia, who can get in there and do stuff for us when need be. And when you consider that a great many people are reading their Wall Street Journal on devices, their phones, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
It does. There's been this massive revolution. I mean, I can't believe my career seems like really two different careers. I mean, there's the newspaper one early on, and then whatever's happened in the last 6 years. I mean, the pace has been insane. What is
the last time you did something where you thought you might get fired if it goes south? Because there have been some pretty big stunts.
Yeah, God, all the time. I mean, I think...
You commissioned an ice sculpture of Roger Goodell during Super Bowl week when the Super Bowl was in the Meadowlands. Yeah. How much did that set the company back, by the way?
You know, I remember it was around $1,000.
$1,000, okay.
It wasn't, so I didn't think that...
that's like a sushi lunch for Kevin Clark. $1,000 for this.
But the worst part of the ice sculpture was the fact that what we didn't realize was that when it froze, we didn't think of what would happen when it started to melt. And it didn't just melt into liquid.
Well, it melted during the actual game.
Literally during the game. I mean, the joke was, you know, it's a cold weather Super Bowl, so we're going to put a frozen sculpture of Roger Goodell and see if it melts before the game. It literally melted in the middle of the game, but it didn't melt. It fell over.
It fell over.
Broke the. It was out on the terrace in our building, and it broke through the floor and caused a lot of damage.
And the best part about it was I was sitting next to Sam at the game, and I got a text message photo. I check my phone, and it's a photo of the statue having collapsed and crashed through the floor. And I turned over and I was like, Sam, look at this photo. And it was very funny. The look on Sam's face was, we better enjoy this game because Monday.
Might be the last one. Yeah. And you also did some stuff, Sam, with the Olympics, where you commissioned a group of artists to render the 2012 London Olympic Games with popsicle sticks.
Yes.
Making basically a mockery of the tape delay coverage that NBC was refusing to air live. They were, embargoing these great races. So Sam had this idea that we're going to take toothpicks and we were going to do skits. You know, because you can't use Olympic footage, Jim. You know, they pay billions of dollars for this stuff. If you use it, you're going to get your butt sued. But Sam had no compunction about, you know, showing everybody Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps and whomever else and did what they were called homemade highlights.
Homemade highlights.
And did any part of you think, you know, Mr. Murdoch's going to find this on his laptop and he can say, what the F is this? And that would be curtains.
No, because the editor-in-chief at the time, Robert Thompson, got wind that we were doing this and came down and insisted on participating.
This is true. It's an important part of the Sam Walker sports section origin story that the only man crazier than Sam Walker was the editor-in-chief of the newspaper, Robert Thompson.
He was way crazier than me. And I mean, some of the ideas he had. And in fact, when he left and he went to run, you know, News Corp, I mean, my whole goodbye speech was just a long list of all the crazy story ideas he suggested we do that would have gotten us fired, and him too.
Probably.
It was. We were definitely, we had a little bit of a wind at our back there with him.
Okay. I want to close out by talking about a topic which is important to the free for all. We've talked about it many times on this pod, and I've talked about it with you privately, which is the idea of sports media and the sports media quote unquote bubble. The idea of the way that the sports economy has developed in the last generation and what might happen were it to collapse. Now, sort of the background of it is that, you know, leagues are getting rich and rich and rich as thick as pigs on these massive network deals that networks are overpaying, frankly, for because sports is one of the last live event things that people feel they have to watch live. So they watch commercials. So, you know, the NFL gets billions of dollars. NCAA tournament basketball, billions of dollars. And yet you can't find someone under the age of 21 who has a TV, much less appointment watches a TV. And so what happens in the next generation? And do you think that we're going to have a real correction in the sports economy, or is it just going to all slide nicely over to our iPads and devices and there'll be no interruption or changes?
I think there'll be massive systemic changes. I don't know if – I think athletes, because they're celebrities and they're going to use their celebrity, will continue to be well compensated. Right. But no, it'll be
a shortstop of the Yankees not going to get $30,000 a
year. He's not going to be that school teacher money anytime soon. No, it's a huge revolution. I mean, it's really going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to it as a journalist, just because it'll be really fun to cover. But no, it's going to be a massive change, and you know, everything is on the table. I mean, honestly, another thing is people attending live sporting events. I mean, that's on the table. I don't know, you know, what we're going to do with these stadiums in 30 years. I mean, I'm not sure that they're going to be full. I mean, they might be. They might not, and I really don't know how.
You don't think that live events will continue to have a premium as we, you know, we become more and more unto ourselves and trapped in our own digital worlds, as you know, we basically are now, but you don't think that there'll be a premium on the experience of actually going to something?
There'll be some. Sure, yeah, no, I don't think it's going to be massive. But
you
I
just
think,
don't think it'll be 80,000 a weekend?
No, and I don't think you can. I don't think that, you know, there's so many different events and things to choose from, and it's already been a problem, but I mean, I think people are going to pick and choose what they go to, and you know, they're going to be a different format. I mean, You know, I think the funny thing is, though, I think that, you know, once the TV situation corrects itself, I think there's going to be a period where live attendance is crucial to these teams. I think where the revenue that they get that they're forgotten about now is suddenly going to be important. So maybe they'll really come up with some revolutions and making the experience of watching a game better. Or maybe they're just back it all up and make it prehistoric. No phones allowed, you know, fans on the field.
I've had the same thought. I mean? Yeah, no, and also, like, you know, getting rid of sort of national coverage. I feel college sports, for example, the idea, why am I watching, like, 13 San Diego State football games, you know, here in New York? Like, that's what's the point? Jim, any last questions for the boss
here? Well, I was going to say, you right now, when you go to a live sporting event, it's one of the places where you can't even really use your phone because reception is so bad at a lot of stadiums.
You need a better phone, Jim. I can use my phone just fine. what else do you want? Let's tell this story, okay, because it's a good one. A couple years ago, Jim Cherusmi dilly-dallied off to the Kentucky Derby because, as avid listeners of the Free For All know, Jim enjoys the ponies. He loves betting on, what do you call it, betting on four-legged things?
Four-legged animals?
Four-legged animals.
Only four.
I don't bet on two-legged animals.
And Jim runs into, you know, some mystic in the parking lot who gives him a tip, proceeds to bet the trifecta, cleans up. And like a true gambling man, tells everyone he knows. And it actually becomes a little bit of a point of conversation within the walls of the Journal, right? Can the guy who is a sports editor collect on his winnings? Does he have to give them back somehow? Tell me a little bit about that, because I just love watching Jim squirm.
Well, this is not a question the Journal ever grappled with before. I mean,
horse race winning.
I mean,
can't imagine, though, in the history of the Journal, he's the first rail bird.
No,
I mean,
but he's the first one who won.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was like, I mean, plenty of like people have thrown their money away. But no, this is a funny place. I mean, the Journal for years, you know, you had so much inside stock information that, you know, you weren't allowed to own it. You're still not allowed to own
individual
stocks.
I get it entirely. But I feel like the thing that was important perspective here is that who do you want writing your sports, your horse coverage? Do you want the bum who doesn't know anything or the guy who just picked the trifecta at the Kentucky Derby? I mean, that was a career-making thing for Jim. That put him on the map.
That was the biggest thing, I think, that the biggest change. And I think one of the biggest changes we've made to this institution, just the sports department, is that, which is it was
hiring
huge,
a degenerate.
Hiring degenerate gamblers, writing stories by squirrel lawyers. And no, but the main thing that I wanted to point out here is that, you know, we made it clear that when you cover sports, you can't divorce yourself from being a fan. And that's one of the problems that sports writers have. And this was the genius of you, Jason, is that your columns, like, you were just who you were, and you were, you know, going along with it, and you had your prejudices and your ideas. But that set a tone, I think, for the whole enterprise. I mean, we're fans. Like, we have our passions, and we indulge them sometimes in the coverage, and sometimes we don't. But we're allowed to be people. And as a sports fan, you kind of are your allegiances, and you are your prejudices. That's who you are, and we've been able to
nakedly honest. Nakedly honest. Now, Jim, I don't know if you know this, Sam, but Jim, last May, when he was bopping around Vegas for the Pacquiao Mayweather fight, put $100 down on Sarah.
$10.
$10.
$10 at 250-1 to win the NCAA title.
So this was on Syracuse, Jim's
alma mater. I was aware of this.
So had Syracuse won the final, you would have won what?
$2,500.
Now,
it's $10. It's a fun bet. In fact, our colleague Ben Cohen told me at the time, I was bragging because I shopped for a good price. I showed him the ticket.
Right.
I was like, I got 250-1 on
that
Syracuse
to win. That is a great odd. I mean, but they really thought they were going to have
unranked,
a rebuild.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Ben said I essentially set $10 on fire.
Oh, $10. He's crazy. By the way, that's the best bet you can make is the futures bets. You go to Vegas before the season, and you bet the futures because there's always a surprise team in the.
Yeah.
You know, I won money on the Angels in 2002 with the same.
But essentially, my point was, look, I put down $10. I don't cover Syracuse.
Yeah.
I have no inside knowledge. It was just sort of a ticket I put on my refrigerator that I could, every time I watch a game, I could use that as an excuse on why I'm watching the game. Hey, you know,
But it must have ruined the Final Four for you.
I didn't think they had any chance. Yeah. You had asked me, hedge this bet? There's not. It was sort of just all in fun anyway.
Okay. Sam, thank you so much for being a part of the free-for-all. Before you go, I want to ask you, because every editor, every reporter has the white whale story, the one that they never got, they tried, the thing that they would... What's your white whale, Sam?
Oh my God, the white whale.
You know, what's the one that you always wanted to crack?
I can't tell you
something, but I just mean like, you know, all right, let's tinker with that a little bit. What did you want to go see? What did you want to go write about that you never got the chance to? A Wednesday afternoon Mets game.
Yeah, no, you know, I didn't get to the Masters, and now I realize it's too late, and I thought I'd love to do that.
You did famously publish a big chunk of the membership list, though. Is that true?
That was another story. But no, we did actually publish a certain number of executives who didn't want anyone to know they were Masters members.
This was back in the days when they didn't invite people to participate in Augusta National. Now it's a very enlightened place. Sam Walker, we owe you literally our careers.
I owe you mine.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Jeez. I think that, you know. So thank you.
Thank you.
We're getting a little misty here. Jim's crying, just sobbing up a storm. Jim, do you have any last words
for
Sam?
Get him a hanky for God's sakes.
Yeah, it's been fun. And Sam was one of the bigger, supporters of the sports podcast.
By the way, Sam, on you going out the, you know, it's like, you know how these presidents like pardon people. You made this daffy decision that Jim has been my editor now of many years, where we speak, we don't even have to speak, we're so in sync, and I love Jim. And now Jim's running off to cover the freaking Jets and the Giants. What's up with this? I had no say. I didn't know anything about this. What gives?
I see in Jim the next great. I see Red Smith, and then I think he's been held back.
Jim's happiness is immaterial to this conversation. I'm not concerned about Jim. And
look
first
at
of all,
Jim, he glows. He's glowing.
Jim is a season ticket holder to the New York Jets. The idea that he now has to spend it in this like antiseptic press box, Jim. You realize you're not going to be able to dress
the
up
only
in your goofy pals.
And the only downside is I can't bet on either team either. So that's a big downside.
I just want to see Jim yelling, screaming, drinking a beer, and smoking in the press box, and making a big scene.
It's one of many terrible ideas you had on the way out, Sam. So, thank you, Sam Walker, Free for All. Thanks for joining us here. Remember, subscribe to the Free for All on iTunes and your preferred podcast service everywhere. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.